Good afternoon, everyone. It's wonderful to be here. My name is Linda Smith. I'm the CEO of the Refirement Network, an independent organization, a thought leader mainly to the 50 plus generation, looking at the opportunities and the challenges that this generation faces as they're moving into this next two or three stages of life, because there are two or three of them. The world of technology and things like COVID are completely changing the way in which and the pace of how change is happening. And I had watched the Carte Blanche clip last Sunday and then was in conversation with Rob and felt that it would be really good to do an education session on life rights, just to be able to give the full picture to the process rather than to just see a slice of what was shown. But what we would like really to do this afternoon is not to relate to specific villages, but to keep the discussion generic in nature and to deal with the issues rather than specific villages or organizations. So I'm going to hand over and we are going to do a question and answer session between Rob and I, where we are going to chat about some of the challenges so that we can make sure that we bring some clarity to this situation. So Rob, the first question I want to ask you is, did you watch the Carte Blanche episode? And what's your opinion of this segment on life rights?
Hi, Linda, and hello, everybody. Yes, I did. I watched it in full. I think that perhaps the segment was obviously, unfortunately, focused on the sensation, you know, the developer's lack of payment. But my concern was really that it didn't balance that narrative with the many benefits of life rights schemes, both locally and around the world. So, you know, given the current economic crisis and the COVID-19 slowdown in sales for most retirement villages, it was of concern for me that people would see life rights as this negative thing, whereas it has many, many benefits for retirees.
Wonderful. So based on what was in the episode, do you feel that the complainants have a legitimate case?
So I think so, yes. I think that, I don't want to specifically comment on a particular developer, but the estates and sometimes people who have life rights and then terminate the life rights because they're moving to a different city or for whatever reason, they terminate the life rights. They have a right to know that the developer will stick to the letter of the contract. And as soon as that is resold, they should be paid out. So yes, absolutely. And Derek Watts was right in pursuing the matter and, you know, getting them on the table with them and getting them to admit that, you know, it had to be paid out. So yes, I do think they had a complaint.
Okay. And the amount that the complainants were talking about and referring to, is this the amount that they paid for the life rights units?
Exactly. So every life rights contract is, in South Africa, unfortunately, there's no regulation around what you should get back in a life right. Every life right contract differs almost, but and it is exactly that amount that you're going to get back. So you buy the life right, you pay for it up front, you live there for the rest of your life and your partner's life, and then the contract will stipulate how much you get back if you terminate the contract or if both you and your partner passed away, how much will your estate get back? So that's what they're referring to.
Okay. So what is it that people normally get back from an estate owner when they either terminate this agreement or they, in most cases, pass away?
Okay. Again, unfortunately, in South Africa, this differs quite vastly. It does relate somewhat to the amount you pay for the unit, but people get back either nothing. So it's a range from getting nothing back. You'll pay an amount, it'll be a much smaller amount then, or you'll get back everything that you paid for the life right, and in some cases, even some of the profits. There are a few life right sellers who will even give you a percentage of the profits. I've seen up to 25% of the profits being available. So it really depends on who you're dealing with in the market.
Okay. So do all life right contracts only pay out after a new purchase has bought that life right?
Yeah, so the life right schemes that I've seen that have failed have been those that do not stipulate that they'll only pay out after the next purchaser has bought in. And there's a good reason for that. You know, if five people suddenly pass in a month and the developer has to come up with 5, 10, or 15 million rand to repay that, that's a massive cash burden on the owner of the life right scheme. So almost every good life right scheme that I've reviewed over the last 10 or 11 years, that repayment amount is only paid back after the next person has purchased and all the conditions have been satisfied and they've occupied the unit. So that is very common in the market.
Okay, for what reason would a life grantor, the owner of the estate, not pay out a life right loan?
So the only reason they can have for not paying back that amount is obviously if the unit hasn't resold. That is probably the most common reason. And you know, the case in point here that we're talking about didn't have that as an excuse. And all of the people that Derek Watts interviewed, they had resold the unit, I think. But there are cases where, you know, sometimes the children are expecting money to come back to them, but the person who purchased the life right has already granted that money either to the organization they bought the life right from or to some other organization like the SPCA. And of course, then perhaps the children weren't aware of that. And the other possibility is that during the course of their life right time, they had amassed certain costs or they had moved to frail care and the developer had agreed to pay for those frail care costs against the life right amount that it was owing. So, you know, when the final accounts are settled, there may not be as much left as children or the estate may wish, but that would be, you know, that should all be transparent and very clear to anybody who's involved in the case.
And are levies still payable after once a person has died before the life right money has been paid over?
Yeah, so in most life right schemes, the levy is still due and payable after both parties have passed or after termination and until it's resold in. But it's often a much lower levy than would normally be payable because you're not eating the food, you're not using the laundry, you know, you're not using all of the cleaning services. So most developers will drop the levy, but most owners of life right villages will drop the levies for you as soon as you've terminated the contract and you're no longer in the unit and it's for sale.
Okay, so Rob, if I'm thinking of buying into a life rights unit, what are my rights?
Yeah, so there are a number of rights. And part of the reason why I like life rights personally is because of these rights. So I'm just going to run through some of them. All life rights schemes must be endorsed in terms of the Housing Development Schemes Act. So that gives buyers protection because the Act regulates the sale process. It holds the developer to a certain standard. And the developer must make a number of disclosures to you as the buyer in that process. I can mention some of those. For example, they must tell you all the details about the property, you know, the architecture, the design, information about the site. They must tell you whether they have a bond over the property and whether they owe money on the property. And they must also give you a copy of the title deed, which should be endorsed to say that the retirement village is being developed in terms of the Housing Act. Then they must forecast your levies for 3 years, and for at least the first year, those must be fixed. They must give you a detailed breakdown of what am I paying for in my levy. They must give you a budget for operation of the estate, and they also will be protecting you in terms of the Act because they cannot just decide the next week that this isn't going to work as a retirement village. We will, you know, we'll make it into a normal estate. That is not permitted in terms of the Act. They would need to get almost the permission of every single person who'd already purchased. So when you're buying into an estate like this, you know, you want to have some protection in terms of those things. And I'm just going to mention a couple more of the benefits which go with those rights. And they are, you know, you would generally see a very high quality of build in a life right village. Why? Because you don't own the building. You know, it's owned by somebody else and they want to make sure that it's a low maintenance cost and that it will resell and resell in the years to come. So when you're buying there, you can be pretty sure that the finishes are good. You know, they're going to use good quality taps. The building work will be good. Then the other benefit is they owe you this money. So While you're living in the village, towards the end of your life, we often get more and more frail, and generally there's one person left in the home towards the end of their life. It's usually the lady, because the gentlemen tend to pass before their wives. And so then you can, in some cases, rely on that capital that's owed to you to help you out should you need to move to a frail care in the village. Some developers will help you with that while they are busy selling the home. So I find that to be one of the good benefits. You know, that's kind of a safety net for you. You also don't have any of the hassles of normally owning a home. All of the maintenance of the brickwork will be done by others. And so the best life right operators will look after all of these hassles that you have as a homeowner. And often when we're talking to couples, one of the two would not have been used to dealing with maintenance issues and housing issues. And so you want to have that peace of mind that you're not going to have that problem in the future. Also, life rights are commonplace. So around the world, these are very well known. A good advantage is that you will never be asked to pay a special levy. If you bought into a sectional title scheme in a normal village, you would have to pay a special levy from time to time for things. That's not permitted in the life right scheme. So you have this predictable levy going forward. Of course, there's no VAT on life rights, and there's also no transfer duties or registration fees related to life rights, because it's not registered in the deeds office. It's a right, it's a life tenure, which is a very strong right under our law. So yeah, those are some of the benefits and the rights that you have as a life right purchaser.
Okay.
I'll just mention one more perhaps, Linda, and that is, if you're buying into a group that has got a number of life right villages, it's fairly easy for you to be able to move between villages, because there's no deed office, you know, transfer duty and all of the hassle that goes with it. It's merely a matter of coming to an agreement on the value of the other unit versus yours, and then it's a move and a new contract and you're done. So very low cost to move between these villages. But of course, then you need to find a group that has more than one village in the stable.
So Rob, there is a question here from Steve to say, is it fair to say that a frail care in a life rights village is of a better quality?
That's a very difficult question to answer, but I will say that where the life right grantor, the owner of the life right village, has a frail care scheme or a care scheme, it's generally of a higher quality than other villages, generally speaking, because of course their name is behind it. So they have to make sure that it's operating properly and that it's well managed and cared for. So yes, I would say very generally they are better.
And what happens if a life rights unit is not sold? What happens then?
Okay, so if a life rights unit doesn't sell, again, I always have to refer back to the contract, the specific contract that you have. But the better life right contracts will have two things in them. A, if they've been trying to sell it for some time, they will allow you to appoint an agent to help sell it after about 3 months, I think. And then secondly, they will allow you, or they will lease the unit out on your behalf just to cover those, you know, those levy costs. The estate doesn't want to be paying that, and you may not want to be paying that. So better contracts try to help you. The thing that people forget is that in a difficult market, the same problem exists for people in a sectional title unit or in a freehold unit in a retirement village. Everybody's struggling to sell. So it's the same problem. You know, you're not going to get your money out until the market recovers. So it's no different for life rights. It has to be resold before you get your money out. But in the interim, you can lease it or appoint your own marketer.
Okay, great. So thank you for that, Rob. If there are any questions from the floor, you're either welcome to put your hand up and I can get you to take yourself off mute, or you're welcome to put something in the chat box. And where Rob can, he will answer. But keep it, as we said, generic, not to a specific village, but rather a deep understanding of life rights that you may be grappling with and need a little bit more depth of understanding. Louis.
Okay, we haven't bought yet, but after seeing the show, I must say there's a couple of negatives, and I appreciate that you're open enough to try and give us some answers. Now, just on the principle, the business plan as such, you know. And in this carte blanche, they said you buy for, and they used an example of 1.7, and many years later, you only get 1.1. Okay, we don't know what happened in between. And then he adds on that the asset value of this whole operation is like 2 billion rand. Now, we know asset and cash flow is two different things. But I would have thought that if I was running a scheme like this and I sold my constructed home in the estate for 1.7, I would put some of that money away for one day when I have to pay it back. One would have thought there's something in the business plan that would cover that. And the other issue is when they sell it. And we know, and Rob raised it, things are tough. I think people are living longer, and therefore you've got this asset which is running and running and running, and you can't sell it to generate some cash flow. And I think we all experience that, trying to sell a home or trying to buy a home. Well, buying is a bit easier than selling at the moment. So my issue is, should not some of that money that you paid up front should be put away to be paid one day? I was under the impression as soon as you move out, you get your money. That's what I thought. Maybe I'm wrong there. So I've got to rely now on salespeople or somebody to sell my home that I've been living in for 10 years before I get money back. And then there's a major deduction, and I'm using the example. So really, my confidence level in life rights is pretty low. Maybe, Rob, you can try and change that.
Thanks, Louis. I think, first of all, yes, you are wrong about getting your money out as soon as you terminate. That is definitely not the case. And where that has been the case in some villages here in the Western Cape, they failed, which is a much worse scenario for the residents than anything else. So, yeah, that is definitely not the case. I saw your question about the 1.7 and the 1.1 paid out. And look, it really...
It wasn't paid out, by the way. Sorry.
No, it should have been paid out. It should have been paid out. So there have been a number of schemes over the years. Some of them said, right, you pay 2 million for the house, and then every year that you live there, what you get back reduces by 10%. I've seen schemes like that. Okay. Some of them go down to 50%, and then it stops there. Some of them, you know, after 3 years, you get nothing back. It really is about the contract. And I get a lot of queries from developers asking about this, but I would say 90% plus of the contracts I work with, you get your money back or you get 90% of your money back. You know, it's one of those two. There's the local CPIA here in the Western Cape, and I'll mention them by name because they offer a product where you get all your money back plus 25% of the gain. Now, if we must talk directly about these things, in the vast majority of cases, you never really leave the village. You know, you're buying a place to retire in and live in for the rest of your days. And so that never happens that you are waiting for money. You know, your estate will certainly be waiting for the money, and the sales process is vital. But a lot of these villages, especially here in the Western Cape, a lot of these villages have got people ready to move in, because they've been around for 20 years. I work with one village here in the Western Cape who they very, very seldom have a vacancy for very long, because people are waiting to get into the village. And so it's, in fact, I can think of two or three of those villages. So if you're buying into a good village and you're buying into a reputable developer, then, you know, that's first prize. So I think you had a question about a trust, but I'm not sure which organization you're referring to there.
Yeah, I just, reference was made on carte blanche that six of the units was in a trust of the one man and six with brother, you know, and although he wasn't rich, he was wealthy, which I thought was quite a joke, But the point is really that they're sitting on assets worth 2 million.
Right.
You know, 2 billion, you know, yeah. And you just ask yourself, there's something fishy.
So I can explain that a little bit, Louis. Think about it like this. You build a block of flats, say, for 10 million rand, 10 units, and you sell them on life rights. So you get 10 million rand from the bank, you build a block of flats, you sell each of them for 1 million rand. Now your balance sheet looks like this. I've got land and buildings worth 10 million, and I've got debt worth 10 million. I owe the life right people in this building 10 million. So there's no cash. If I'm a clever businessman, I'm not going to sell it for 10 million. I'm going to sell it for 12 million. I'm going to keep 2 million for cash needs, right? So that's what you were saying. And all of the responsible developers will not sell it at cost. They will have a little bit of extra in there and they'll manage the bathtub curve. After about, I would say, 8 to 12 years, the first Lightright units start turning over, in some cases sooner. And then they're starting to make a little bit of cash flow. And generally, if they can make it through the first 10 to 12 years, they're well on their way. You must understand, life rights is big money, okay?
Yeah.
It's good business for developers who do a quality job. The reason that Evergreen and all of these people are getting into this business, which I'm very grateful for, is because there is money to be made, but you have to be a responsible developer. If you take the CPOA or the Fair Cape Group in the Western Cape and a number of others, including AMDEC, they all have well-established track records and they have been through that tough period where they had to watch their cash flow very tightly, start making some money. Now, financial management is absolutely crucial. They have to always manage their reserves so that they can see through the tough times. And I don't think anybody expected this year and a bit of COVID-19 drama to hit us. So that's been especially difficult for villages that are trying to sell and get going because the suburban homes are not selling as fast as they used to, and so they can't sell. But yes, you're right. They have to make cash allowances. I found the arguments that we put forward in the carte blanche episode. Well, they weren't really good arguments put forward by the developer. I mean, he has no excuse. He sold the units, he must repay them. And that's the bottom line. I mean, there's just no excuse for that. So I know he may not call himself a rich man, but he is certainly richer than 90% of South Africans. and he's doing okay. You know, he's not struggling. So he needs to make those payments. And that's just my opinion.
Great.
Thank you for your question, though. I hope that helped a little bit.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rob. So Ian has asked a question here in the chat box. I've heard of a special levy being charged in a life rights village. Can a special levy be charged and called by another name?
That's an interesting question. I've not had that before. I mean, a special levy is a levy that's over and above your usual levy. Why do we have the Housing Developments Act? We have it because we as retired people need stable costs, stability, predictability of our lives going forward. And so a special levy is a problem for most retirees because they're on a fixed income, they've got their investments. Now, where must they find this additional cash? They have to then release investments, which they don't want to do. So the Act's intent was good. It was to say no special levies. Now, I've even heard some lawyers argue that you may not have any special levies in any form of retirement village. Doesn't matter whether it's life rights or anything else. And I have a problem with that because if you own the village, then special levies are a possibility. But in the case of life rights, you do not own the village. And so you cannot have special levies in my personal view. And that's what the Act was trying to achieve. Comfort for people retiring into these schemes.
I see Margie Chapman has put a comment in that the PADCA, which is in, I think in KZN, offers 80% of the selling price back, not 80% of what you paid. And that the detail, as you've said, is in the contract and in the investment. And so I think it really is pertinent, and I've seen it in a number of different life rights companies that I've looked at. Every contract is different. the devil is in the detail. And I think, Rob, you are suggesting that if you're spending this money, that you get a lawyer to make sure that they read the detail for you so that you understand it.
Right. I mean, APADCA is an interesting example. I mean, would I advise a new developer to do 80% of the selling price versus 80% of the purchase price? I would not. Not without doing a very, very careful analysis of the finances. For me, it's more important that they make their money. I pay a price that I'm happy to pay. I'm going to live there for the rest of my life. If I choose wisely, life rights are a brilliant option for me and my wife. They can even be more brilliant for children who are over the age of 50, because I can buy a house in a retirement village at the age 50, and I can put my parents into it, and after they're done with it, I can move in. So I can hold that life right for a very, very long time. And, you know, some developers have got special ways of getting out of that, and they won't let you do that, but there are some that will allow that. So, yeah, APADCA offering 80% of the selling price, I think I would think about that very carefully before accepting that, or before going down that road as a developer. For you as a buyer, I don't really think it matters that much. It's probably better for you getting 80% of the selling price. But, you know, then the problem is always, what are they selling it for? And are they selling it to, you know, for the best price? And I don't know, there's all sorts of issues there. So I like this thing about just give me the money back into my estate. I can plan ahead. I know what's happening then. And as long as you're a healthy organization, you know, that's the most important thing. We need the organization running the life rights to be solid. And most of them offer the money back that you paid for it. So, I mean, I know APADCA I haven't worked with for a very long time now. And I think the lady that was there is now consulting that was running the place. A wonderful group. And I wish them well. But their life rights were struggling at one stage, you know, to make headway. A lot of them struggle because they have a large charitable part of the business, APADCA, CPOA, Rand Aid. These guys are awesome. You know, they're all looking after a lot of people on social grants. And so they balance their books with life right revenue. And we need to support these organizations and make sure they don't disappear off the landscape.
Right. Any other questions? Louis, you got another one? I don't see any other hands right now, so go ahead.
I just want to, you know, the issue for me is, Rob, you've now sort of said there's people who run a good operation, there's those that run a bad operation, and in between. Now, as a potential buyer, can I have a look into the books? You know, because, you know, I don't want to get caught up with what we saw on Carte Blanche. I want to be caught up with a good professional outfit, but also financially sound. Now, is there a way that a potential buyer can look at each group on a financial basis?
So, I mean, a group like Amdex, Evergreen, are a publicly traded, I think they're publicly traded Amdex. Maybe you wouldn't get the books of Evergreen, but, you know, I think that's a partnership between PSG and Amdex. If it's a public company, you'd probably be able to get some insight from their annual statements. The CPOA, as an example, is a public benefit organization, and so their books should probably be available to the public. But you'd have to approach each organization individually. And, you know, annual financial statements can tell you something, but you can see how well the villages are run by also looking at each individual village. Speak to the residents, see if they're happy. I think we've got to talk later this week about things to look out for when you're going, you know, looking for a retirement village. I think Linda's got one that I'm going to be attending. And I, you know, I always say, ask 1,000 questions, meet your neighbors, ask for the minutes of the last AGM, look at the financial state, you know, of the village, never mind of the group. Now, do your research. And a lot of, too many people don't read the constitutions, don't read the rules. And then they give me a call, or they give somebody a call after they've moved in. That's really a little bit too late. So spend a bit of time. You know, the better agents will help you with all of that information and give you too much information, in fact, if you ask for it. But yeah, I mean, on my website, there's a free guide you can download in English or Afrikaans. It'll give you all of those guidelines. Just go to shireprop.com and it's a free guide. It might be a little bit dated now, but these things haven't changed much. You need to know what to ask for, and I really encourage you to ask as many questions as possible. Agents have to be very patient people. I know there's some agents on this call, and they've been working on some leads that took 5 years to make a sale. So they are patient people by their very nature. It's normal, and don't be afraid to ask them lots of questions. They would welcome that.
Thanks, Rob. Any other questions? Lisa.
Hi, Rob. Yes, I am actually an ex-Evergreen agent, and I was with AMDEC for 10 years. So I know exactly how it all works. And that is a question that gets asked very often, by prospective purchasers. And often I would say they are more than welcome to actually speak to a financial advisor within our company. AMDEC were very hesitant and they never did show the figures. But they were more than welcome to get comfort in talking to one of our financials.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I think speaking to financial advisors, and even independent financial advisors, most companies wouldn't have a problem with that. They won't get you the books, you know, certainly not the day-to-day books. The financial statements or annual financial statements don't tell you a lot of detail, but they can give you an idea whether the company's healthy or not. Yeah. I don't think that's a problem with any of the big players anyway. But yeah, you're right. That's a good response. I think I will change my answer to that in future.
Great. Thanks, Lisa.
Pleasure.
Anybody else?
I'm talking too much, but
no, it's fine.
What would have been nice?
Yeah.
What would have been nice is quite a few of the residents to be on the Zoom meeting, you know. That would have been great. I don't know if there are, but at the end of the day, I know my sister-in-law is there and I thought she might be on, but that's got nothing to do with it. Now,
Just to answer your question, I think we're having a separate session with the residents of the estate you're talking about. Of course, you're welcome to sit in on that as well. You know, it's just that residents talk about different things. We're talking about very specific issues around that estate. Yes. So, you know, if you're in the market for that estate, chat to your agent. They might invite you to that internal session, and I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Now, I think if you look at the estate, now there's freehold and then there's life rights. Now, the freehold on an estate where there are life rights, they treat it separately, aren't they? I mean, you buy and sell your home there. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a freehold home. So you buy and sell it as you would in any estate.
As you register it and you pay VAT and all that.
The whole duty. It's a private home. Yeah.
Okay. That's all.
Both of those sections of the village would fall under the same rules, same master association. They would both be treated as equal residents, but the freehold people can buy and sell as they please.
I really appreciate that.
Not a problem.
Very much. Thanks a lot.
Not a problem at all.
Thanks, Louis. Anybody else? We said we would go as long as there were questions to answer. But we don't have to go longer than there is need. Derek.
Yes, there we are. Okay, hello. Rob, hi there. Derek Swarenberg.
Hey,
Rob, have you come across retire at home and res care and these type of structures whereby people who are hesitant to get involved with going into a retirement home or retirement village, and they want to go on a stepping stone basis where they get brought in frail care and care at home. Have you got any experience with that, and would you like to comment? Thank you.
I think we could have a whole separate webinar about this, and maybe we should, because I'm very passionate about the changing care model in South Africa. I see Erica Janic is on the call, who's the nursing sister at the Somerset, and she knows that I'm very serious about changing the care needs of South Africans, or not the needs, but how we manage those needs. So, yes, in recent years, we've seen probably tens of these home-based care organizations pop up in every city of South Africa. Some good, some not so good. Many of them were just a one-man show with a nurse who said, well, yes, you know, I can make it, I can survive if I offer the service at home. But the likes of ResCare, which is headed up by Arthur from ex-AMDEC, ex-Evergreen General Manager, is a serious attempt at making available services to people in their homes in the Western Cape, in a very small part of the Western Cape now, but hopefully it'll spread. And the idea is that much the same as in the better retirement villages, you can call on a little bit of care as you need it. So as you find certain functional things declining, you know, you're struggling to maybe get up in the morning and get going, but that's, you just need somebody to help you for an hour. In the better retirement villages, you can get that in from the service in the village. Now, what ResCare and others are offering is that same service in your home. It's more expensive in the suburbs for obvious reasons, because you're not sharing those care workers with a lot of other people, but it's certainly becoming available. And in Australia, I have one of my colleagues lives in Brisbane, and I've seen some of the local brochures of services like that in Brisbane, where you can get pretty much any kind of service you like in your home. And it's not just about care, it's about everything, okay? From walking your dog to taking you shopping, just depends on your need. So I think over time we may get some of those services here. I think it's wonderful. Some people were worried that it would be the retirement village killer, but I don't think that's going to be the case. I think it's just an alternative to those who aren't quite ready yet to go and live in a retirement village, or who never want to live in a retirement village. At least we can be sure that they can get good services incrementally until they, they can't afford it anymore. So I think it's an excellent scheme, and I would support anybody that is trying to make it work. I think it's a very tough job, a lot of logistics and labor issues. But yes, brilliant scheme.
Great. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Derek. Anybody else?
Linda, we should probably have a chat like this about care. You know, Margie Chapman's here. We've got lots of people that can talk for ages about care, and especially the latest changes that we think are coming, that we pray and hope are coming. You know, maybe we should have a session about that as well.
Wonderful. Happy to do that. So thank you, Rob. I really appreciate the fact that you've been open and transparent. And for me, this has been something I've been saying for a long time, is life rights is more complex, and we need more education to be able to help people to make good decisions up front, and to really just understand what it looks like. So I really appreciate the fact that you've done this, and we are grateful to each person who's come onto this call. As Rob said, he doesn't often consult individually with people, but if you have a question that you really want, he has put his email details in the chat box. And he has said you may email him with a specific question, and he will attempt to answer it. So thank you very much, everybody.
Well, thank you, Linda. Thanks for hosting the session. Appreciate that.
Pleasure. Thanks, everybody.
Oh, thank you, Linda. Thank you, Rob. Most enjoyable.
Bye-bye.